Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, December 1st, 2022. President Joe Biden welcoming the French President Emmanuel Macron for a state visit to the United States. A joint news conference at the White House, the two expressing solidarity with Ukraine in that country's war against Russia's invasion, characterizing Ukraine's military victory as a victory for democratic values everywhere. But the two leaders clashing a bit on clean energy trade, with President Macron saying that he and other European leaders are concerned about incentives in the new U.S. climate and tax law that favors American-made technology, including electric vehicles. President Biden says he makes no apologies for that legislation, but perhaps there are tweaks that can be made to make it easier for European countries to participate. U.S. Senate joining the House in passing a bill that will prevent a freight rail shutdown. The Senate vote of 80 to 15 to impose a proposed labor settlement that some rail unions have already rejected. In a separate vote, the Senate did not pass legislation that the House did to change the labor deal to add additional paid sick days for those rail workers. A Senate committee hearing on the FTX cryptocurrency trading platform's bankruptcy, as the debate continues over if and how best to bring crypto under effective regulation. And House Democrat-elect Congressman Jim Clyburn of South Carolina, the current majority whip, to be minority assistant leader in the next Congress. The vote was by acclamation after his only challenger, Congressman David Cicilline of Rhode Island, withdrew his nomination. And now to the White House South Lawn. An elaborate arrival ceremony for the state visit of French President Emmanuel Macron and his wife Brigitte, the playing of the French national anthem and a 21-gun salute, guests waving small French and American flags. There was also a review of the troops and the Army's Old Guard Fife and Drum Corps in their bright red coats and three-corner hats, dressed like the military musicians from the Continental Army during the American Revolution. President Joe Biden, in his welcome remarks, explaining why he chose France for his first state visit of his presidency and some of the issues the two leaders will be addressing.
The temperature may be a little chilly on this December night day, but our hearts are warm and to welcome such close friends to the White House. President Macron and Brigitte, members of the French delegation, distinguished guests, it's an honor, a genuine honor to host you for the first state visit of my administration. And to celebrate the enduring strength and vitality of the great friendship between France and the United States of America. As my friend and I were talking, France is our oldest ally, our unwavering partner and freedom's cause. From the spirit of Marcus de Lafayette, who helped secure the success of our revolution, to the sacrifice of American GIs who stormed the beaches of Normandy, our history has been shaped by the courage of the women and men who crossed the Atlantic, carrying within their hearts the flame of liberty. Today, that flame burns more brightly than ever, and the alliance between our two nations remains essential to our mutual defense. As allies in NATO, together with our European Union and the G7, and partners around the world, France and the United States are facing down Vladimir Putin's grasping ambition for conquest and Russia's brutal war against Ukraine, which has once more shattered peace on the continent of Europe. France and the United States are once again defending the democratic values and universal human rights, which are the heart of both our nations. The wellspring of our strength is a shared commitment to liberty and justice for all. Liberté, égalité, fraternité.
President Joe Biden at the state visit arrival ceremony outside the White House this morning. The French President Emmanuel Macron in his remarks stressing the long friendship between the U.S. and France and the two countries' shared values.
Nous sommes à la fois honoré et ému d'être en ce jour à vos côtés, à la Maison Blanche. Honoré et ému, vous l'avez dit, Monsieur le Président, à l'instant, car nos deux nations sont sœurs dans leur combat pour la liberté. La France, dès les origines de l'indépendance américaine et de la construction de votre nation, les États-Unis, par le sang versé des tranchées de la Somme aux plages de Normandie.
We are both honored and moved, Mr. President, to be here with you today at the White House. Honored and moved, like you said, Mr. President, because our two nations are sisters in their fight for freedom. France, from the beginnings of American independence, the inception of your country, and the United States, in the lives sacrificed from the trenches of the Somme to the beaches of Normandy.
Et cette histoire commune nous oblige. Aussi, face au retour de la guerre sur le sol européen suite à l'agression russe contre l'Ukraine et face aux crises multiples qui frappent nos nations et nos sociétés, il nous faut savoir redevenir frères d'armes.
Accordingly, we bear a duty to this shared history. As war returns to the European soil following Russia's aggression against Ukraine, and in light of the multiple crises our nations and our societies face, we need to become brothers in arms once more.
Through an interpreter, the French President Emmanuel Macron joining President Joe Biden on the White House lawn this morning, the start of the French President's state visit. From there, the two went into the White House, meeting in the Oval Office, and then held a joint news conference in the White House East Room. The first question from the reporters was about trade. As Associated Press writes it, President Joe Biden on Thursday acknowledged glitches in America's clean energy law that have raised concerns in Europe, but said there's tweaks we can make to satisfy allies. French President Macron has made clear that he and other European leaders are concerned about incentives in the new law, known as the Inflation Reduction Act, that favor American-made climate technology, including electric vehicles. President Macron said that while the Biden administration's efforts to curb climate change should be applauded, the subsidies would be an enormous setback for European companies. That from Associated Press. Here's the question and the answers at the joint news conference.
The first questioner is going to be from AFP, Ms. End.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would have a question for you and one for the French president, if I may. To you first, you now say that you're going to better coordinate, especially your green economic policies. But yesterday, Emmanuel Macron said that the Inflation Reduction Act is in fact super aggressive, I quote, for European companies. Does it mean that you are ready to grant exemptions of irrigation to European industries? And now my question to you, Mr. President, est-ce que vous allez repartir de Washington avec la...
Mr. President, will you leave Washington with the assurance? That you will be able to deal with these massive subventions. The journalist doesn't have a microphone. So you think there's a risk of generating divisions?
I'll answer the last question since I didn't hear any of it. I didn't understand a word of it, so I'll answer it.
And we'll take care of it.
No, look, the United States makes no apology, and I make no apology since I wrote it for the legislation you're talking about. But there are occasions when you write a massive piece of legislation, and that has almost $368 billion for the largest investment in climate change of all of history. And so there's obviously going to be glitches in it and need to reconcile changes in it. For example, there's a provision in it that says that there is an exception for anyone who has a free trade agreement with us. Well, that was added by a member of the United States Congress who acknowledges that he just meant allies. He didn't mean literally free trade agreement. So there's a lot we can work out. But the essence of it is we're going to make sure that the United States continues, and just as I hope Europe will be able to continue, not to have to rely on anybody else's supply chain. We are our own supply chain, and we share that with Europe and all of our allies, and they will, in fact, have the opportunity to do the same thing. So there's tweaks that we can make that can fundamentally make it easier for European countries to participate and or be on their own. But that is something that is a matter to be worked out. There is no fundamental, it was never intended when I wrote the legislation, never intended to exclude folks who were cooperating with us. That was not the intention. The intention was to make sure we're no longer in a position when there was a pandemic in Asia and China decided they're going to no longer sell us computer chips. We invented the damn things. But my point is, we're back in business. Europe is back in business. And we're going to continue to create manufacturing jobs in America, but not at the expense of Europe.
What we've been discussing with President Biden and what, as a matter of fact, he just said, and that's what I talked about with the caucus yesterday, that's simple. The United States of America adopted a piece of legislation for their country, for their industry, which with a common objective, goal that we share, creating jobs, creating opportunities for the middle class, and succeeding in implementing the energy transition. The reality is that the consequences, as we've seen in our discussions, it is certainly not the intention of the United States, but as a matter of fact, projects that were growing, being developed in Europe, there's such a difference in subsidies that these projects might come to an end. And a number of senators yesterday said it was certainly not their intention. So France simply did not come to ask for an exemption or another for our economy, but simply to discuss the consequences of this legislation. And the news, the circumstances mean that we have no alternative but to work together. So therefore, I believe we need to resynchronize, as I say, find a new policy to clarify our goals and continue together. And the discussion we had this morning was extremely clear. And I could feel the very same intent on behalf of the members of the Congress yesterday. The wish of President Biden is to rebuild a strong industry here and to have somehow to secure some technology solutions for the future. France wishes exactly the same thing for itself. And we've been fighting day in, day out to do the very same thing in our country. And this enabled us to put an end to some 15 years of industry loss in our country and to have new manufacturing jobs. And so we'll be working on that. And we decided to do that together with the other members of the European Union and the European Commission. So we will work on the technical elements to make sure that there is no domino effect on ongoing projects in Europe. We want to succeed together, not one against the other. It's been clear. This is the outcome of our discussions this morning, and this is exactly the philosophy that I share, and it is the one that we need.
More now on the French President Emmanuel Macron's state visit to the United States. On the phone is Eli Stokols, White House correspondent and co-author of West Wing Playbook for Politico. The joint news conference at the White House between the presidents, the first couple of questions dealing with trade disagreements and climate technology. How big of an issue is this, and was anything solved today?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? It's not something you hear a lot about in American media, but when the French president comes to town for a big state visit, and this is the obvious point of tension, point of friction in an otherwise really healthy, productive relationship between two old allies. It is what you're going to read about and hear about. And not surprisingly, that was one of the few questions that got asked at this press conference where four reporters, two from each side, were called on by the two leaders. Look, it's no secret, given that Macron and others in Europe have been pretty outspoken about this. They are frustrated by some of the tax credits for other new energy provisions that were passed in the Inflation Reduction Act. And there are also concerns about some similar provisions in the CHIPS bill that passed earlier this year, aiming to boost America's semiconductor industry. The broader concern in Europe, this is a continent where folks are pretty rattled about the economy, the impact of the war in Ukraine, the impact on energy prices and on other things. You know, the recession fears there are a lot more acute than they are currently in the United States. And economists and elected leaders there have been concerned that, you know, these new policies in the U.S., which are viewed over there as being fairly protectionist, could, you know, or just sort of exclude European manufacturers and companies from a lot of the tax incentives for clean energy development. And there are concerns over there that some in that industry in Europe could migrate, taking jobs and production over to the United States and shutting down European facilities. And so that's a problem. Macron has talked about it. He talked about it yesterday, you know, before members of Congress. And he and Biden talked about it in the Oval today. And during the press conference, there was not a lot of daylight. I think that both leaders were acknowledging that they're talking about this in good faith. And President Biden said, you know, look, I'm not going to apologize for the Inflation Reduction Act. There's a lot in there to reduce carbon emissions, but that it was never anyone's intention to exclude countries across Europe, especially France and others, Germany, that are critical allies on Ukraine, on China, on a number of other things, and on curbing climate change broadly, which is what that bill is supposed to do. And Macron really backed him up and said, we take the U.S. at their word that they're working on this and that, you know, we're all trying to achieve the same goals. And so, you know, there are some working groups tasked with trying to iron out some of these snags that we'll continue to meet. There was not really any major policy breakthrough out of today. But, you know, if anything, they tried to sort of ratchet down the tensions or the appearance of tension. And we'll see where this goes in the coming months.
And as you mentioned, just a couple of questions allowed at the news conference. The other ones dealt with Russia's war in Ukraine, and there it seemed to be more of a united front.
Right, and I think, you know, that what was surprising to people in Europe about some of the issues around trade and the IRA is that, you know, otherwise, outside of that, the Biden administration has managed the alliance since the war began almost flawlessly and kept, you know, the Europeans locked in here in spite of the very direct and almost immediate economic consequences on the other side of the Atlantic. And so, you know, the cohesion there on the Ukraine war continues, and I think was also a feature of what messages, you know, that both leaders were seeking to convey. And, you know, the questions, you know, we're nearing the winter months. Putin is losing on the battlefield, but still indiscriminately bombing Ukrainian cities and civilian targets. You know, there's a lot of question about how is this going to end? When is this going to end? And whether the countries like the United States that are sending basically, you know, the bulk of the defense aid that Ukraine is using, countries in Europe, including France, that are sending, you know, massive humanitarian aid, taking in refugees and being impacted by, you know, the scrambled environment in terms of energy and the energy markets. How much longer can this go? And, you know, both of them basically said the same thing, which is that there's no way they are going to push Ukraine to negotiate, you know, before the war is won. They are not going to make concessions to Vladimir Putin, that this is bigger than short-term harm, you know, economic harm, short-term inconvenience. This is really about sovereign nations and what's at the heart of the UN Charter. And, you know, I think that's a pretty important message. Biden was asked at the end, you know, if he would speak to Putin. And he said, I want to choose my words carefully. I will speak with him if he's looking for a way to end the war. But he acknowledged it doesn't appear that Putin is doing that. And, you know, he said, you know, what Putin is doing is sick. He said that Putin has miscalculated at every turn and that he's not going to win. Essentially, he said the idea that Putin is ever going to defeat Ukraine is unimaginable. And Macron said the same thing. And so there continues to be no daylight on the support for Ukraine. Macron was asked the question slightly a different way whether or not with Republicans taking over the House and some on the far right of the House GOP caucus expressing more skepticism about writing, quote, a blank check for Ukraine, if he doubted whether the U.S. would continue to be there and to be standing behind Ukraine if this war continues for a long time. Macron said he didn't really have any doubts, and he said he thought the American people recognized the importance, not just of the USA to Ukraine specifically, but for all of Europe, because this, you know, he said, is really a security matter for all of Europe and really for all the world, you know, to make this stand and to show that, you know, you cannot just invade a sovereign country and take it over, you know, and expect there not to be any pushback.
Eli Stokols, White House correspondent, co-author of West Wing Playback for Politico. You can find his stories at politico.com, and on Twitter, he's at Eli Stokols. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And back to the joint news conference at the White House, President Biden answering that question about Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Look, there's one way for this war to end, the rational way. Putin to pull out of Ukraine, number one. But it appears he's not going to do that. He's paying a very heavy price for failing to do it, but he's inflicting incredible, incredible carnage on the civilian population of Ukraine, bombing nurseries, hospitals, children's homes. It's sick what he's doing. But the fact of the matter is, I have no immediate plans to contact Mr. Putin. Mr. Putin is, let me choose my words very carefully. I'm prepared to speak with Mr. Putin if, in fact, there is an interest in him deciding he's looking for a way to end the war. He hasn't done that yet. If that's the case, in consultation with my French and my NATO friends, I'll be happy to sit down with Putin to see what he wants, has in mind. He hasn't done that yet. In the meantime, I think it's absolutely critical what Emmanuel said. We must support the Ukrainian people. The idea that Putin is ever going to defeat Ukraine is beyond comprehension. Imagine them trying to occupy that country for the next 2, 5, 10, 20 years, if they could, if they could.
President Biden at the White House. You can find the joint news conference with the French President Emmanuel Macron at our website, cspan.org. Well, that was happening. First Lady Jill Biden and the First Lady of France, Brigitte Macron, visiting Planet Word in downtown Washington, D.C. Planet Word describes itself as the only museum in the country dedicated to renewing and inspiring a love of words and language. Dr. Jill Biden quoted as saying, "We instantly, you know, knew that we liked each other." Speaking of Brigitte Macron. And tonight, there's a black tie state dinner at the White House. 300 guests invited. The menu includes lobster, caviar, and a course of American artisanal cheeses. The decor, according to the First Lady, is red, white, and blue, the common colors of the U.S. and French flags. The entertainment will include John Batiste, the Grammy-winning musician and composer. C-SPAN spoke with Anita McBride, former chief of staff to First Lady Laura Bush, about what goes into preparing for a state visit.
Protocols are very important. You know, of course, the chief of protocol at the State Department has primary responsibility from the moment that foreign visitor arrives in our country to the minute that they leave. They are never unescorted. They are always are treated with the utmost of respect. That is protocol that we extend to a foreign visitor, but also is extended to us when we travel overseas. So the chief of protocol and his or her team have primary responsibility for making sure all of the protocol details that are international standards are adhered to. And then, of course, the social secretary at the White House has the major and almost exclusive responsibility of making sure all those details are executed properly when on White House grounds. Leading up to a state dinner is a lot of frenetic activity. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One, all of the planning that you and thought that you have put into the visit, you know, for months, now comes down to game day or the days leading up to game day. And so a lot of checklists, a lot of all hands on deck. Of course, the resident staff of the White House has a huge role to play. The 90 plus people, every single one of them are on tap for making sure the house is in pristine condition, that the food is prepared, that the china's been selected, that everything is ready. The carpet, red carpets have been rolled out, that all of the rehearsals, you know, have happened at the White House. So a lot of activity that leads up to the final day. It is really something to behold, to watch. And it's, I guess you can liken it to, you know, all of the calmness above water when all the, you know, frenetic paddling of the feet and hands is going on down below. Because one of the other things to remember is that life at the White House and work at the White House doesn't stop while you're planning for and executing a state dinner. There's still a lot of other things going on. You know, it's still other visits, other work that's happening at the White House. Press conferences may be going on, other events, but you have to work around all of that to be ready for state dinner game day. You know, it's really interesting. I never was worried because knew so many of the details were reviewed over, you know, and over again. I think you worry about things that for the arrival ceremony, if there's inclement weather and you have to change things, you know, that's something you can't control. The things that we can't control, we didn't worry about as much. But outdoor events and outdoor activities can be fraught with peril, you know, rain, snow, whatever, you know, it might be. Those are the things that you worried about, what you can't control.
Anita McBride was chief of staff for First Lady Laura Bush, interviewed by C-SPAN. This is the second state visit for the French President Emmanuel Macron to the U.S. as France's leader. He was here in 2018. He was then President Donald Trump's first state visit as U.S. president. And today's state visit is the first for the Biden administration, 2 years into his term, because the COVID-19 pandemic has put such get-togethers on hold. The White House Historical Society has a list on its website of previous state visits from French leaders, 14 of them, and it started in 1931. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and also through the C-SPAN mobile app called C-SPAN Now. The U.S. Senate passing a bill that will prevent a freight rail shutdown. The House passed it on Thursday, so it now goes to President Biden to be signed into law. He says he'll do that as soon as he gets that bill. The bill requires railroad companies and unions accept an agreement that was negotiated by them through a presidentially appointed mediation board, even though some of the union rank and file have already rejected that agreement. The final vote in the Senate today was 80-15, with one senator voting present. That's Republican Rand Paul. Of the 15 no's, the Republicans are 10. It's Tom Cotton, Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, Marco Rubio, Rick Scott, Pat Toomey, Susan Collins, Tim Scott, also Hagerty and Sullivan. 5 Democrats and the independent who caucuses with them also voting no: Gillibrand, Merkley, Sanders, Hickenlooper, and Warren. Ahead of the Senate vote, there were 2 other votes in the Senate on this issue. One was an amendment by Senator Dan Sullivan, Republican of Alaska, that would provide a 60-day cooling-off period for industry and union negotiators to continue talking and try to work towards a deal that can be accepted by all. That amendment failed 26-69. And the other vote in the Senate was on the House passed bill that would change the original labor agreement and add 7 paid sick leave days for rail workers. That failed in the Senate 52-43. Got a majority, but it needed 60 votes to pass. On that bill, 6 Republicans voted for the sick leave measure: Braun, Cruz, Lindsey Graham, Hawley, Kennedy, and Marco Rubio. One Democrat voted no: Manchin. Here's Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, talking about that bill to add the sick leave days.
President, the American people are increasingly disgusted at the level of corporate greed that we see today. We have more income and wealth inequality in America now than we've had in 100 years, billionaires getting richer, working people falling further and further behind. And there's no clearer example of corporate greed than what we see in the rail industry today. In the last year, that industry earned $21 billion in profit, record-breaking, provided $25 billion in stock buybacks and dividends to their wealthy shareholders. And yet today in that industry, workers who do difficult and dangerous work have zero paid sick days. Zero. You get sick, you got a mark against you, a couple of marks, you get fired. This cannot and must not happen in America in 2022. This amendment simply says 7 paid sick days for workers in the rail industry, and I hope we can win it.
That's Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, on the Senate floor before the vote, and there were not the 60 votes needed to pass that bill, that amendment that he referred to. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican from Iowa, argued against adding the extra sick days to the rail labor agreement, but for the original agreement in an interview on Newsmax Wednesday night.
If this rail strike would happen, it would cost the economy $2 billion every week. And in addition to that, for a state like Iowa, where we have to move our grain on a regular basis and get inputs into the production of food on a regular basis, trains are very, very essential. And it would just shut everything down. So in the tradition of what I did in 1991, when the last time Congress was involved in something similar, I would vote to impose the presidential emergency board recommendations. Mm-hmm. Which is what the president did in late September, I would vote for Congress to impose that. But I would not want to vote for anything else than that, like, for instance, what the House of Representatives did by imposing some things that hadn't been agreed to between labor and management, have the Congress substitute itself for those labor management arrangements. I wouldn't be in favor of that.
Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican from Iowa, during an interview on Newsmax Wednesday night. And again, today the Senate did reject adding those extra sick days for rail workers, but passed the original agreement. And when President Biden signs it into law, it will head off any chance of a freight rail strike. Right before the votes in the Senate today, President Biden asked why the two issues were kept separate.
President Biden, do the freight rail workers deserve more than one day of paid sick leave, like millions of Americans have? And if so, why didn't you negotiate for that when you were helping to negotiate that contract that you now want Congress to impose?
I love you guys. I negotiated a contract no one else could negotiate. The only thing that was left out was whether or not it was paid leave. You know, I've been trying to get paid leave, not just for rail workers, for everybody. But that other team, they're called the Republicans, they voted against it. They said we couldn't do it. We're one of the few nations in the world that don't have paid leave for our workers. And so what we're doing is we can't afford to have, and by the way, in the meantime, they got a 45% increase in salary, et cetera. There's a lot of good things that happened in that. And in fact, this shuts down over the question of 1 to 5 paid, or 7 or 9, whatever the numbers, and be negotiated of paid leave days. It's going to immediately cause 750,000 jobs and cause a recession. And so what I've made it really clear is that what was negotiated was so much better than anything they ever had that it's worth, and they all signed on to it, by the way. There are only 4 unions that, out of the 13 or 14 that didn't agree. So the majority at the time was that I presented it, they asked me to do it, I presented it, they all signed on. But here's the story. It doesn't mean because we are going to pass this, God willing, on by Friday, by the time, by the weekend, that I'm going to back off of paid leave. I made it really clear I'm going to continue to fight for paid leave for not only rail workers, but for all American workers.
President Biden at the White House, that was during the joint news conference with the visiting French president, and with Congress's intervention, the Senate did pass the original agreement today. The House had passed it on Thursday. President Biden plans to sign it. That means The possibility, some say the likelihood, of a rail labor strike as early as next week has been taken off the table. There is another deadline looming. Federal government funding expires on December 16th. Roll Call reports that the prospects of a lame duck omnibus spending bill remain murky as Republicans and Democrats have not reached a top-line spending agreement. The current continuing resolution runs out December 16th, though lawmakers have discussed a stopgap extension of perhaps a week to buy extra time. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi at a news conference today saying, well, it's possible that CR, continuing resolution, could go the entire year.
We protect the financial security. The Congress remains hard at work until late at night, last night, starting early this morning, on the omnibus funding package. It's about taking us into the future. Passing an omnibus is our strong preference. Our leader in the House on this, of the House Democrats, is Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro. You've heard me say again and again, as an appropriator myself, left to their own devices, the Republicans and Democrats, in a bipartisan way, on the Appropriations Committee, can reach a solution. And we should let them do that. But sadly, we have no choice if they can't, that we would have to have a year-long CR. We don't like that, but if we can't have a solution, we have no choice but to keep government open with a year-long CR. We've made that very clear in the White House meeting the other day and in our conversations with our colleagues on the subject. It would be a last resort because, as you know, it would have a direct impact on so much that we want to do in the legislation, but we have to have agreement.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat from California, at her weekly news conference, an omnibus spending bill would fund the government for the rest of the year. A CR, continuing resolution, for the rest of the year would fund it at just current levels. More from the Roll Call article. They write that House Republicans are willing to punt government funding into January if no agreement is reached, Leader Kevin McCarthy said. Republicans will have a slim House majority in the next Congress. He wants to cut discretionary spending below the fiscal 2022 enacted level, which was a little over $1.5 trillion. By contrast, House and Senate Democrats' proposed spending bills would appropriate closer to $1.7 trillion. And Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell said that while there is widespread agreement on an omnibus and that it's better than a CR, Republicans want increased defense spending and more funding for Ukraine. That from Roll Call. Wall Street today, the Dow down 194, NASDAQ up 14, S&P down 3. Commerce Department inflation report for October, the Core Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index officially, which does not include food and energy costs, rose 0.2% for the month and 5% from a year ago. CNBC writes that that was about in line with estimates, and it sends a signal that price increases at least might be stabilizing. The U.S. Supreme Court agreeing to review the Biden administration's effort to reinstate the student debt relief plan put on hold by a lower court, but the justices declined to immediately reinstate the program while the case is pending. The court said it would hear arguments in February. A Senate committee hearing today on the bankruptcy of the cryptocurrency trading platform FTX. The Wall Street Journal puts it this way. Senators with a plan to regulate cryptocurrency said Thursday that last month's collapse of digital asset exchange FTX shows legislation to oversee the industry is critical to pass. Senate Agriculture Committee Chair Debbie Stabenow, Democrat from Michigan, said her committee's legislation addresses the risks posed by practices that took down FTX. She particularly took aim at reports that FTX misused billions of dollars in customer funds to rescue an affiliated trading firm that made risky venture investments. C-SPAN covered the hearing today. The only witness was the chair of the Commodities Future Trading Commission, CFTC, Rostin Benham. Here are the questions from Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois.
So let's talk about FTX for a minute. Less than 3 years old, supposedly worth $32 billion, 1 million users, and it collapsed overnight. I saw what Mr. Bankman-Fried was tweeting. I suppose that's where his users get their information. And he led them right up to the cliff, the edge of the cliff, and then they fell off and couldn't recover what they had invested. in the process. I just might add, and I think it should be noted by all the members on this committee, there'll be a reporter waiting in the hall, I've already talked to her this morning, who will ask you, did he ever contribute to your campaign? I said, oh no, I never heard of the man. She said, you're wrong, Senator, he contributed to you. So the cryptocurrency people are active politically, and they are trying to achieve a political end here. It is their right as citizens of this country to do that, but it really calls on us to make sure that whatever we do is credible under those circumstances. How long will it take to unpack the FTX mess to be able to understand exactly what happened and where it stands today?
Senator, I think, you know, we have a cursory understanding of what happened. We've mentioned this today, the commingling of funds, the conflicts of interest, the lack of a custodian to separate those funds, the lack of books and records, as John Ray has said, just a sort of complete disaster from a risk controls. I think that's fine at a cursory level. I think it's going to take months probably before we truly understand the extent and scope of the failure.
And who's going to do that investigation?
Senator, as I mentioned to Senator Thune, you know, we are a civil enforcement agency. We are using the full extent of our power under the law to police any infraction or violation of the law. I know our sister agencies across the U.S. and the globe are doing that as well. Enforcement cases take time, but we're moving expeditiously, and we understand the importance of this.
So this legislation, which is before the committee to consider, is to enhance or improve your authority in this area. Is that correct?
It's to fill a gap over commodity spot tokens, correct.
All right. So I find this interesting. I want to put it in this perspective. It seems to be there is a competition, at least at the Capitol Hill level, between those who believe there should be no regulation. This is the new world order. You don't need the full faith and credit of any nation or known entity as long as your computer program is sophisticated enough. I'm skeptical of that personally, but that seems to be one point of view. The second point of view is CFTC is a nice agency, but it's a small agency, and this is a big, big problem and challenge. If it's going to take you months to figure out what happened to one of the larger players when they collapsed overnight, how are you going to maintain the daily regulation of this industry that is, at least until the recent collapse, was mushrooming in size? And there are some who say, you got a fundamental problem that you face here. When you want to fund the CFTC's activities, you come hat in hand to members of Congress because you need an appropriation. The SEC is largely funded by fees charged to those who are using the regulated entities. Now, I know that you ask for a user fee as part of this. And as I understand it, your general appropriation is in the $300 million range for CFTC. Is that correct?
$320 million.
And you believe that the user fees you're asking for from this digital industry will generate how much?
Well, Senator, it depends on how much appropriators set the level at. And that would obviously require collaboration with us, but what we would have to do if the DCCPA passed at the agency level is determine what funds we needed to implement the rules and to enforce and impose the rules, and then provide a request to you, and you would set the level, not unlike the SEC, and then we would collect those fees requisite with what you set the level at.
So ultimately, Congress has something to say about the user fees.
You have all to say.
Commodity Futures Trading Commission Chairman Rustin Benham, questioned by Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, at today's Senate Agriculture Committee hearing on the collapse of the FTX crypto platform. You can find the full hearing archived at our website at cspan.org. The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, writes the Washington Times, broadsided his Democratic House counterpart Thursday, painting Congressman Hakeem Jeffries as an election denier for previously questioning former President Donald Trump's 2016 win amid claims of Russian interference. And the Washington Times article has this paragraph as well. The public critique of Mr. Jeffries, which came the day after Democrats elected him as Democratic House leader, previews the likely tense working relationship that is to come between a GOP-led House and a Democratic-controlled Senate. Here is Senator McConnell on the Senate floor today.
It has been one of the big unfortunate ironies of the past several years. Many of the same individuals and institutions on the political left who spent the years 2017 through 2020, yelling about the importance of norms and institutions, have themselves not hesitated to undermine our institutions when they're unhappy with a given outcome. Just as an example, the newly elected incoming leader of House Democrats is a past election denier who basically said the 2016 election was, quote, illegitimate, and suggested that we had a, quote, fake president. He's also mounted reckless attacks on our independent judiciary and said that justices he didn't like have, quote, zero legitimacy. Unfortunately, when it comes to attacking our independent judiciary, the Democrats' new leader isn't an outlier. He's a representative sample.
That's the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky today on the Senate floor. The minority leader in this Congress expected to be the minority leader in the next Congress. Democratic Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren of California, a member of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, telling CNN this morning that the committee held its last interview with a witness on Wednesday, and the committee will publish its final report by the end of December. She was also asked about a committee meeting happening on Friday to discuss possible criminal referrals and also about plans from the incoming House Republican majority to review the work of the committee.
Tomorrow, I know there is the meeting about the criminal referrals. That has been something that people have been watching closely. How many criminal referrals do you expect to make, and will Trump be one of those?
Well, I can't tell you that yet. We haven't had our meeting. And honestly, we meet multiple times a week, sometimes virtually. And we've gone through, again, we want anything we send over to DOJ as a recommendation needs to be tethered to the facts that we found. And if we don't make a recommendation, and this is not relative to Mr. Trump or any other person, it doesn't mean necessarily that we don't think that they shouldn't investigate. But we want to make sure that we are on firm ground if we make any recommendations over to DOJ.
Is it fair to say you are considering criminal referrals, though, for those Republican lawmakers who defied subpoenas from your committee?
Well, we're trying to consider what to do with the members who defied the subpoena. There are separation of powers issues that we're considering. That's very important to the members of the committee. The Constitution is important to the members of the committee. So we'll come to a resolution on that as well.
And yesterday you saw Kevin McCarthy say that he wants the committee to preserve its findings, even what doesn't make it into your final report that you noted has to be printed. Are you concerned that when Republicans take over the House, they will try to undermine the work that the January 6th committee has done?
Well, they've been pretty clear that they'd like to undermine the work that we've done, but we're going to prevent that. We're going to release all the information we've collected so it cannot be selectively edited and spun.
Okay, so everything's going to be released.
That's correct.
Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, Democrat from California, interviewed on CNN this morning. She is a senior member of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol. The House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, has also promised Republicans will investigate, in his words, why the Capitol complex was not secure on January 6, 2021. And the Washington Post reporting tonight, a federal appeals court panel on Thursday halted an outside review of thousands of documents seized from former President Donald Trump's Florida residence, ruling that a lower court judge was wrong to appoint an expert to decide whether any of the material should be shielded from criminal investigators. Donald Trump had sought that outside arbiter known as a special master after the FBI executed the court-approved search of Mar-a-Lago, his home and private club, on August 8th, retrieving more than 13,000 documents related to the former president's time in the White House. But 100 of the documents were classified, and some contained extremely sensitive government secrets, according to court records. That reporting tonight from The Washington Post. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, to get the stories Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. Subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.